My number one album. Big shocker to me. Also Folklore.
Whoa.
Are you ready to dive into all things Taylor Swift?
Good for a Weekend is the ultimate podcast for any Swiftie.
With new episodes dropping bi-monthly, as well as bonus episodes to give you real-time reactions to the latest rumors and news, it's your one-stop shop for all things T-Swift.
We also love connecting with our fellow Weekenders, so be sure to connect with us on Instagram, Twitter, and or Discord to share all your Taylor thoughts.
Good for a Weekend is available wherever you get your podcasts. I know.
Lamar just is that. Like, it's a perfect album.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello and welcome to The Spark Parade, a show where I talk to amazing people about the art and culture that shaped their lives. I'm Adam Unz. Thanks ever so much for joining me. Coming up, you'll get to hear my chat with a writer. And he's not just any writer, folks. He's one of my favorite writers, Paul Tremblay. Paul writes books that I guess it's fair to classify as horror, but that feels a bit reductive to me. They are scary and intense and all of the things that you expect from horror, definitely. But his writing is so moving and vivid, and it affects me emotionally in a way that no other horror writer can. He writes with such incredible empathy. If you'd like a suggestion for an entry point into his writing, I can't fucking help you. It is all so good. I want you to read all of them all at the same time. Are you up for that challenge? You're stuck inside anyway, so you might as well try, right? Anyway, end of gushing intro. Paul and I had a really great chat about the seminal punk / post-punk / grunge / alternative band Husker Du and the solo work of legendary Husker Du member Bob Mould. We also shot the shit about growing up, finding your way in the world, developing your taste, so it was a wide-ranging conversation, really. I know you must be terribly excited to hear it, but tough shit. You've got to listen to me for a while longer. Or rather, I would appreciate it if you would indulge me a bit further, because I want to talk a little bit about children's books. So, Tommy DePaula died this week, and hearing that news made me incredibly sad. For anyone who doesn't know, he was a writer and illustrator mostly of children's books, and most famous for writing the Strega Nona books. He was the last living author in a group of children's authors who were really important to me. And just like most of my favorite Christmas songs were written by fellow Jews, most of my favorite children's authors were fellow gays. Authors like Tommy DePaula, Maurice Sendak, Arnold Lobel, James Marshall. And that's an important aside because these guys injected subtle, child-friendly queerness into their books, both implicitly and explicitly. Tommy DePaula's book, Oliver Button is a Sissy, was a prime example of that. But the impact those books had on me went beyond the queer infusions. Those stories are burned on my brain. And the illustrations, too. They're vivid and funny and full of love. Another childhood favorite was Ezra Jack Keats. He was also a Jew and was, let's say generously, a sexual question mark. But I digress. His books had a profound impact on me. And just after we moved to New York, my husband and I went to a Hanukkah party at the Jewish Museum. A Hanukkah party at the Jewish Museum in New York is fucking peak Jew, by the way. But the party coincided with an Ezra Jack Keats exhibition, and they let us in for free. I was walking around these larger-than-life recreations of my favorite moments from books of his, like The Snowy Day and Whistle for Willie and Peter's Chair, and I was absolutely overwhelmed with emotion. I was probably weighed down by the stress of the move, and I was a little bit drunk, but walking into that room just floored me, and I burst into tears. And a huge part of that emotional overload was thinking about these memories of my parents reading to me, of being so small that I could lie on my dad's back and peek over his shoulder while he read those books to me. And thinking back on that makes me realize that it's not just the content of those books that I feel so connected to, it's also the act of being read to. I was so lucky to have parents who read to me constantly and helped me to learn to love reading on my own. It's so fucking important for kids to have that connection. Not only can it instill a love of reading, but it's also this intense, magical connection that never really gets repeated after your childhood. That is, unless you're on the other side of it. So read to your kids, dudes. And if you don't have any, read to other people's kids. That simple act can change their lives. Okay, sorry, enough. Let's get on with the show, shall we? Here comes my chat with Paul Tremblay about Hoosker Doo and Bob Mould. So, Hoosker Doo. And Bob Mould, but I'm assuming Hoosker Doo is the beginning. Actually, I'm not going to make any assumptions. I don't know which music you discovered first. So usually the beginning of every chat is like the origin story. So tell me how you came upon this music.
Sure. So I didn't come across Hoosker Doo / Bob until I want to say sophomore year of college.
Okay.
I'll back up a little bit. Previously, you say, you know, I've just always been like a music fan. You know, music for me, especially as a teenager in high school, starting about midway through middle school, was sort of one of my retreats, one of my safe places. Most days I would come home from school because I was very, very short, very skinny, picked on a lot, didn't have very many friends at all. So most days I would come home and lay down on the floor. You know, I grew up in the 80s. So, you know, we had a record, you know, stereo record player, giant speakers that I would tent. Like I would make like a, almost like a tripod, and I would lay with my head in between the speakers. And I don't know, it started with listening to my, you know, my parents' records. I was the oldest, so I kind of had to, you know, discover everything for myself. And I think my first like real jump into music fandom though was Pyromania, Def Leppard.
Amazing.
Yes. Yeah. Seeing that on MTV. I mean, that's how I discovered music for the first, I don't know, basically through middle school and high school. Because again, I really wasn't hanging out with a lot of friends. It wasn't other people to show me music, is what I've sort of found on my own. Oh yeah, I was in seventh grade, sort of a bad mullet, jean jacket, Def Leppardins on my jacket. Yeah, so through high school, I sort of, you know, found my own way. Like still, punk wasn't really a thing for me, just because, you know, it wasn't as prevalent on MTV as I guess my first foray into harder music was obviously, you know, a band like Def Leppard. But I think my first real taste before, you know, before I hit Hoosker Doo, sorry, if this is a long, boring intro.
No. This is the good stuff. This is what I want. So.
Yeah. No, so, you know, brief classic rock, but then junior of high school was the band Living Color. I was totally obsessed with Cult of Personality first, the video, obviously.
Yeah.
But the whole album itself, because I couldn't afford to buy records, and records were starting to be phased out. They weren't as cool as cassettes, obviously. You know, so I had a Walkman at this point, but also, yeah, I guess I would say I transferred over from the big stereo speakers over my head to the Walkman, and man, that Vivid tape, I wore out. Like I had to buy a second copy because I had played it so much. And that like remained like, you know, my favorite record for, you know, until I, you know, went off to college.
Yeah.
So when I went to college, for me, college was a real sort of blossoming me, you know, having some confidence to become myself and maybe even like who I wanted to be, even though I wasn't sure who that was quite yet. And the people I did become friends with were also music fans, and, you know, and they wanted to work at the school, at the radio station. And, so I started hearing, you know, and this was so 91 when I was a sophomore, I guess. So, you know, we're sort of at the point where, you know, alternative rock is just about to become, you know, a huge mainstream thing with obviously the success of, you know, Nirvana was when everything really blew open.
Right.
So it was right around that time where I'll never forget. I was sitting in my friend Weird Jim's room, his playful nickname. So Jim, and who is one of my best friends in college. So Jim, when he was in high school, you know, he was at a rural high school in New Hampshire, and he was, you know, a punk. He was, you know, Dead Kennedys and Dead Milkmen. And, you know, we went to I went to one of my first, what I would call like, you know, I went to a few concerts by, you know, one or two, like with my parents, was like Billy Joel or something like that. So I went with Jim to see Red Hot Chili Peppers, Dead Milkmen, and Two Free Stooges was the other band. That was like the opening band.
Holy shit.
Yeah, because Jim knew, and this was during Mother's Milk. So, you know, this was before the Chili Peppers kind of sucked.
Yeah.
No, because I still do really like that record. I'll never forget Jim, you know, because Jim looked like a punk, and like I showed up like in tan pants and like a Michigan college sweatshirt, even though I went to a, you know, I wasn't a Michigan student. He's like, oh, yeah, you're going to get beat up at a show looking like that. And I remember being like, oh, no, this isn't what I want.
Yeah.
But no, it was a wild show. It was a great show. So right around that time, we were in his room. And actually, it wasn't a Husker Du album that was playing. It was Bob Mould's Black Sheets of Rain. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure I'm messing up some of the timelines a little bit, because that Chili Peppers concert was second semester freshman year. So maybe it was next year. But anyway, Jim was a part of my life. Someone in the room was playing Black Sheets of Rain, the last song, Sacrifice, Let There Be Peace. And at the time, it's the end of the song where Bob is just, just screaming his head off. Mm. You know, it's a very emotional song, but, you know, having never heard Husker Du or Bob sing before, my initial reaction was like, oh, what's this? This is terrible. he's just screaming.
Yeah.
But there's something stuck there. Something clicked, because, you know, I left the room. I kept thinking about that song, even though I didn't like it, but apparently I did. And because of some of the other musical interests, you know, I was like, oh, so that guy was named Bob Mould. He was in a band called Husker Du. Oh, I've somewhat heard of them. And I found what I could about Husker Du. I think I found a Rolling Stone that had done the best 100 albums of the 80s, or maybe it was like the best 100 albums of all time or something. Uh-huh. You know, and Zenner Cable was on there. So I, you know, as much as I could, there was obviously no internet, did some research about Husker Du, and that, I think it was a winter break of sophomore year, I went into Boston and bought New Day Rising. Was the first album of Husker Du that I bought. And I was just blown away. I mean, life-changing, like, oh my God. You know, I didn't know there was a band like this. And, you know, and from there, I just worked my way through the catalog, and that was the discovery. And it was instantly like, I don't know, it's sort of goofy to talk about, like, oh, you know, because I remember being an age, like, these are my favorite bands. You know, obviously at that age, I stopped keeping a list of, oh, what are my favorite bands? But, you know, for a long time, you know, there were obviously other bands, but it was always, you know, Husker Du was my touchstone. And obviously, well, maybe not obviously, but I've followed Bob to Sugar and all his, you know, his solo projects. Mm-hmm. I never did get to see Husker Du live. Obviously, you know, by the time I had heard Black Sheets of Rain had come out, so Husker Du was no longer touring, was no longer a band. But I have seen... I've seen Bob probably between 25 to 30 times live, you know, wow. Either with Sugar or him solo acoustic, or, yeah, I mean, I guess it's probably a rough estimate, but yeah. We'll call it between like 20 or 30 times. I mean, I've been trying to think of, so I've been a fan of his for just about 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, especially in the 90s, I was probably seeing him close to twice a year. You know, so I'm sure that there was a few years where I didn't see him very often, like during his Modulate sort of years. Yeah. Where he was experimenting with ambient music. But then, you know, things sort of picked right back up again with, you know, especially with the release of Silver Age. Mm-hmm. What was that, 2010, 2011? Uh-huh. Yeah, so I've seen him a lot anyway, but by far the most I've ever seen, you know, any other performer.
Yeah, amazing. That is a beautiful introduction into the subject. But just back it up a little bit. I mean, I talk a lot to people. A kind of recurring theme on this podcast is that pre and post internet divide, and the ways that people found music, the ways that people developed their taste before they had access to literally everything in the entire world.
Right.
And yeah, that experience of like being the oldest child and not really having anybody, you know, any older siblings to kind of hand down music to you, and having to grab things off of MTV, that kind of stuff. I can totally relate to that. Like, you know, even just catching glimpses of, you know, videos or little snatches of things. We didn't have MTV at my house. So like going to my friends' houses and seeing things. But that whole experience. And then also, I'd never really thought about how, I guess I take headphones and personal music players for granted. Just the idea that, like, probably I'm in, when did the first Walkmans come out? Like early 80s, something like that. And that was the first time when you could really have music that was yours privately that you could bring with you, and you know, you didn't have to worry about your parents complaining about you listening to your music out loud or any of that kind of stuff. So sowing the seeds with what you had available to you to kind of develop your own taste. And then I think it's a pretty common experience to have that explosion going to college where you're like finally out on your own. And I think for most well-adjusted adults, high school was a shitty time that everybody yeah. is happy to be away from. And college, you know, isn't necessarily perfect or happy for everybody. But I think it's this like a huge part of a transition to adulthood, but also just
sure.
like, getting to assert your independence and getting exposed to stuff by your peers, by people from like you know, different parts of the country, different parts of the world, and people who come from completely different backgrounds and have a completely different experience. So like having that buddy who is, you know, you meet in college who turns you right. on to something that's like becomes this defining part of your life is so incredible. And that was the biggest value that I got from college, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the few points in life, if you are fortunate enough to be able to go to college. I mean, it is a chance to literally reset sort of like your peer group without it seeming like, you know, you're just like cutting people out of your life kind of thing and start, you know, and actively trying to meet other people. I mean, it's a literal restart, you know, and for me, it meant it's, you know, allowed me to become, you know, who I wanted to be, or at least try to become who I wanted to be. You know, I think more importantly, helped me, you know, allowed me to discover, you know, more of my passions. For me, that's the great lesson that sort of stuck with me is, you know, and I hope that more people, you know, hope more people do have that experience. Like the idea that even now, like, as you know, I'm older, obviously, but I don't know. I think going through that, it helps me appreciate being a fan, and not that being a loaded thing. Like, it's okay to like things, which sounds kind of goofy to say, but like, you know, on social media and everywhere else where everything can be so examined and so down to, I don't know, microscopic levels. You know, I think people forget, you know, it's okay to enjoy, to have enjoyment as a part of your consumption. And that's, you know, a terrible word to use, but you know, music, film, and movies. Not that these things shouldn't be, explored, you know, in their meanings and, you know, in the greater cultural, you know, sphere. But at the same time, just as a person, as a one-on-one thing, I don't know, it's okay to like things. It's funny, I had a, you know, I teach high school now, which is kind of weird because I hated high school so much as a student. It's weird that that's where I, you know, ended up for, you know, my professional life, you know, aside from writing. I had a kid say to me, because, you know, I try to share my passions with my kids. Like, even though I teach math, you know, I'm not necessarily giving them my books to read, but, you know, my room is full of posters, mostly like, you know, horror posters and stuff. But I've had years where I also, like, once a week, just being the obnoxious old person, making fun of, like, the kids' music, and, you know, in some ways playfully. But I used to put up, like, Tune of the Week just so these kids would be exposed to some, like, older stuff. And, you know, I have a little tradition, or every, like, the day before Thanksgiving break, I bring in my electric guitar and just, you know, play them some stuff. And, you know, I had one senior say to me, which, you know, it was interesting, was a senior said it to me, not a freshman, who's sort of in the middle of high school hell. You know, the senior who's, you know, looking forward, you know, he's mature. He's like, it's like, oh, you know, you teach math, you write, you know, I have to coach at my school too, coach basketball. And I do enjoy, like, shooting, you know, baskets. He's like, you know, you like music, or you like music. He's like, man, you know, you're a talented guy. You're like a lot of different things. And I never thought of it as the talented part of it, but I did certainly think of it as, well, you know, you name some of my passions. And I just always thought, hey, I like that. I want to try to do it. You know, why not like try to live that way? But anyway.
And I think having that example for kids at that like really formative, sometimes terrible time in their life where they're just like,
right.
you know, hormones raging, don't know whether they're coming or going, and just lots of really dramatic highs and lows and all that kind of stuff. And, like you said, just having somebody to show them an example of like, it's, you know, it is okay to have taste and to, help to expose other people to your taste. And it may or may not be their thing, but just kind of laying all your cards on the table and saying, this is what I like. And just going to your point about the internet as well, that I think one of the most damaging things about it is it can be exactly like Mean Kids in High School, where you say like, this is what I like. And then everybody shits all over it. And it's like, you know, you really should be able to just say, this is my taste. Taste is subjective. Of course, not everybody is going to like the same things that you like, but just, you know, letting people like things they like and not having to say, you know, express how much you disagree with them all the time. And like healthy debate is fine, and you know, the criticism of art exists for a reason, but
absolutely,
you know, there's a balance.
Well, it's funny, you know, especially, I mean, I don't know, maybe because it's the teacher part of me. And listen, you know, I would never say that, like, you know, I'm the awesomest teacher and I'm always positive, because I get cranky and you know, as a math teacher, you kind of have to be cranky sometimes.
Yeah.
but I mean, if anyone, you know, looks back upon their positive experience, whether it's in, you know, high school or what positive experiences you had in education, whether it be in college or in high school, I think almost invariably people tend to think about a moment of discovery, and the moments of discovery are always, either led by or underpinned by enthusiasm, whether it's enthusiasm from the teacher, you know, probably both enthusiasm from the student and the teacher. You know, it's those moments of, wow, isn't this amazing? Isn't this cool? I mean, that's what makes you want to learn something. I mean, obviously, again, as we discussed, you know, you have to be able to look at things critically, but the initial moment of discovery is always underpinned by enthusiasm. You know, so I don't know. My wish is that more people allow themselves that enthusiasm, you know, particularly if you're coming across something new and you're not sure about it, but you think you might like it, you know, approach it from an enthusiastic point of view first, maybe. Yeah. I mean, even like my way into writing started with my very last class that I took in college, because I was a math major, actually a math humanities double major. I sort of fell into the humanities part of it through a long, not exciting story. But one of my last classes that I took ended up being an English 101 class, essentially. I was a senior in with a bunch of freshmen, because I'd never taken a college English class. And the professor was, you know, really cool. He was sort of the stereotype, like, Dead Poet Society, like, for me anyway, like, enthusiastic. But the thing was, he was a punk fan. He loved the Dead Boys. And so I would be writing papers and comparing, you know, different stories that I read to Husker Du songs or Jane's Addiction or something like that. And he was totally into it. I mean, so his enthusiasm for that actually helped open up reading and becoming a reader. You know, without that, you know, who knows, you know, if I ever would have stumbled upon writing. So I, again, eternally grateful for that. That connection, especially between two different art forms and connecting it through enthusiasm.
Yeah. And I think that kind of enthusiasm, whether it comes from a teacher or your peers or whoever is
right,
exposing you to things that you can become enthusiastic about, it's infectious. It's like, you know, having somebody who's teaching you something in whatever context who is really passionate about it and excited and positive and wants to, you know, expose you to it because it may be something that you're interested in too. I think that also, like, all of this to me is a big argument for why the opportunity to go to college should be available to anyone, because, like,
right,
having that high school experience where you might start experiencing these things, you might start being exposed to things that could be interesting to you later on in life, but you're surrounded by, you know, the worst kinds of energy that you're going to be exposed to basically in your whole life. And it's not easy to be a teenager and be proudly enthusiastic about anything, really. I mean, it takes balls to really to be a teenager and to really show that kind of unabashed joy. And I think college, when you're separated from that kind of an anxiety-inducing situation, you have a bit more freedom to really concentrate on the things that you want to learn about, and to maybe take those seeds that you've gotten from high school or from your parents or from your friends or wherever, and dig in a little bit deeper and think, like, what do I want, you know, what do I want to know? What do I want to learn about? What do I want to do with my life? All those big questions. And, you know, having the freedom to push yourself a little bit further in whatever direction. And, you know, it's not like college is the only way to do that.
Sure.
For me, it was a great opportunity to really get exposed to a lot of different kinds of people and a lot of different kinds of ideas and art and everything. So
absolutely.
So would you say, like, the kind of punkier side of Husker Du and of Bob Mould, like, I would say Husker Du to me feels like a band of two halves. There's, like, the hardcore stuff and the kind of stuff that was transitioning towards what would become grunge and alternative, like, you know, laying the groundwork for what came next. Bob Mould has, at least to my ears, his music goes all over the place. Like, you know, the Sugar stuff is much more, at least, you know, there's these big, like, radio friendly, almost pop hits.
Right.
And then he has done some albums that are really heavy and, like you said, you know, albums that are kind of experimenting with dance music and all over the place. Do you fall anywhere in particular on that spectrum, or is it just like they you know, everything that you've been able to get from the band and from Bob Mould as a solo artist is good.
So, I mean, I definitely fall more, I guess, towards the, I don't know. I mean, a little, I guess sort of depends on the mood. I mean, so I really, you know, I love New Day Rising. It's probably still my, because it was my first, it was my, you know, my favorite, you know, Husker album.
Yeah.
You know, I do like the tuneful stuff, but at the same time, you know, I love listening to, you know, some of the more hardcore stuff, particularly on Center Arcade. So, I mean, some of it's the mood. I will freely admit that I wasn't as much into the electronica stuff that Bob was doing. And it wasn't, you know, I would never be like, oh, I'll go back to doing the old stuff. But I actually, because when he was doing that, I was sort of in the middle of trying to figure out what I wanted to do as a writer, like right around the same time. So, you know, I appreciated that he was pushing himself as a musician, and he didn't want to write the same songs over and over again. For me, at that point, I was still very much a fledgling writer, but I'd been writing all these horror short stories. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to try writing like this weird comedy novel, which to me was like a very important step in my writer's life to figure out that, oh, not every story had to be pigeonholed into something. I was going to, whatever story idea I had, I was going to try to write the best story that I could and serve that story. So, you know, even if I haven't liked everything Bob has done, I've liked most of it.
Yeah.
But I've always appreciated, like, you know, how he's, you know, pushed himself in different areas. And I've always been a Bob guy. I mean, I like Grant Hart's work with Husker Du, but for some reason I was always more drawn to Bob's voice, his songwriting style. You know, it's funny, like, I was thinking, you know, in preparation for this podcast, thinking about, like, the bridge from Def Leppard to Husker Du. And in some ways, you know, there's, you know, the heavier guitars, you know, heavy guitar pop songs, kind of, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me as like the 12, 13 year old and even like, you know, the 15, 16 year old, music for me was always an escape. I didn't really, you know, it was the MTV video. It was like imagining myself on stage and being, you know, sort of, you know, anyone thinking that I was cool. I mean, to me, that was like a big appeal of those songs when I was that age. And honestly, some of that I will freely admit, some of that is still there. Still, as a 48-year-old man, when I listen to some songs sometimes, I will tell you that some of the appeal of listening to a song is imagining myself performing it.
Mm.
I don't know. I don't think I've ever admitted that in public before. No, it's not for every song, but, I still do it. Because part of that, for me, a part of that is part of my creative life, the fantasy life that I've always had since a kid. You know, I think I realized that even though I didn't start messing around with writing until my early 20s, I've always had this fantasy life and even either creating videos for songs in my head or putting myself into these songs. I don't know. I always felt like that was, in retrospect, I think that's great training for being a writer or for being a creative person. But to me, I think the big switch in Living Color was a part of it was, oh, these songs actually are about something, and that, you know, the escape part of it can only really fuel you for so long. And then to me, the you know, Husker Du in particular, those songs all, they became to be about reason in one way or another for me, even if I couldn't always explain what the reason was, like, or how those songs made me feel. But it became less about escape, although, you know, that's still there. But I don't know, just like a raison d'etre. Pardon my French, or attempt at it. So yeah, anyway, I don't know if I answered your question, but that was like a rambly thought I had about the connection to you had asked about, like, you know, which songs do I connect to? Yeah. But I mean, to me, that's been a joy for 30 years. Like, as he's gotten older as a performer, that I've been able to still connect to, you know, so many of his songs that he continues to make now.
Yeah.
You know, his record, I already mentioned Silver Age, is amazing. What an amazing record to put out, you know, at the time when he was 50. And even still, his solo records since then, you know, I always have, like, for each one of those, I found two or three songs that really, you know, sort of speak to me. Maybe not in the way it did. I don't think it does for anybody, like when you're 21, you know, or 18 or 19, discovering sort of, if you're going to call it your reason, but that's okay too, because, you know, I'm a different person now, and the music, you know, what it means to me has sort of evolved as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't think, you know, any artist who has a career that's, you know, spans whatever, probably pushing 40,
yeah, 40
years
at this point,
now,
yeah.
That, you know, sustaining a career that long in any fashion is pretty remarkable, especially for a rock musician. But consistently putting out albums that you can find stuff that you enjoy, and even if it's picking and choosing songs and it's not necessarily like totally devouring whole albums anymore, I think still being able to find music that he's making now that you still dig is pretty pretty nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even like his live show was just about actually barely over a week ago, like 7 or 8 days ago. I saw him in New Hampshire. It was just him and electric guitar. And I don't know, it's just cool. Like even after all these years to still be surprised, like I don't think I'd ever seen him perform the song Flip Your Wig, which, you know, half of the song is sung by Grant Hart and he's sung Grant's parts. It's like, huh, this is really cool. I don't know if I've ever seen him do that. And then actually much later in the set, he played Never Talking to You Again, which is a Grant Hart song. And I know I've never seen him, at least the times that I've been to his concerts, I've never seen him perform, you know, that song before. Or a song that was solely sung by Grant. I don't know. So even though that's not like him creating new music, but, you know, as a performer, it's like, oh, geez, you know, obviously Grant passed away, I think a little over a year ago at this point. Geez, maybe even more because of how quickly time goes. I don't know. It's just fun to be continually surprised, you know, in a show like that where he plays a bunch of songs, obviously, that, you know, he still played some ones that he's working on. So you had some new stuff, you know, so there's the comfort. I don't want to say the nostalgia, but the comfort of the songs that you know, but then there was still these things that, you know, surprised you. So, you know, as someone, you know, who just has his 8th novel coming out this summer, it's, I don't know, it's comforting to see someone still capable of, you know, surprising a self-professed fan who, you know, knows his work, you know, and him so well. I don't know, that's inspiring to me.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I was just thinking, you know, kind of talking about people inspiring each other and helping each other to really discover art and figure out who they are and find themselves and just develop their taste. I think that's kind of what the band did for each other too. You know, they were kids when they met, and there are all these stories. I mean, reading about this stuff, you know, I think I said to you that I grew up in St. Paul. So all of their like origin story, you know, when I was growing up, I always thought that they were just a local band. Like I didn't know that anyone knew who they were outside of Minnesota. I was just like, oh yeah, they're
That's
just
funny.
Like the guys who are, you know, started this like little local scene. Like them, I felt the same way about the Replacements too. Like, oh, they're just like these local guys. Them talking about, you know, hanging out in these record stores in St. Paul and Minneapolis. And have you listened to the podcast, the current podcast that just came out like last year? It's like the history of Husker Du. Yeah, check that out.
Really? Oh, man. All right.
Like interviews with all of them. There's stuff with Jello Biafra and Henry Rollins. And yeah, it's great. But they're just talking about like hanging out and developing music and stuff. And it just sounds like that kind of camaraderie and finding a band where they've ended up inspiring so many people and inspiring like whole genres of music.
Yeah.
And it started out in that same kind of way where it's all just like kids spitballing, shooting ideas at each other, introducing each other to stuff, and slowly kind of developing this style and music of their own. And it's pretty amazing. There was also an interview that I saw with Bob Mulder who was saying that the reason that they were so prolific is that it was so cold in Minnesota that they couldn't go outside, and so all they could do was practice.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you hit on something. I mean, that's sort of the connection to most performative arts or just arts in general is, I mean, the essential step of, if not mimicry, that's not the word I'm looking for, but imitation, excuse me. Yeah. Jeez. Sorry. First day back at school after a week off of being cold and sick. Cause you know, in early interviews I've read of them, I'm sure, you know, they talked about, oh, you know, hearing the Ramones, obviously. I mean, there are a lot more influences on Husker Du and Bob in particular. But, you know, I remember hearing him talk about, oh, hearing the Ramones, like, we can do songs like that, you know. So it always starts off with, you know, some form of imitation. And I think in writing, it's clearly the same way, or at least it was for me. Like, I just tried writing stories that riffed on, you know, different writers, you know, that I liked. And actually, I tried to riff on music quite a bit when I first started. So many of my early stories and so many of just even stories that have been published have started with sparks from music, you know, as the lifelong wannabe musician that was me, you know, sort of sadly found out he was a better writer than he was a musician. Like my first short story collection, which was published in 2005 by, you know, a small independent publisher called Prime Books. I named it after a Bob song, Compositions for the Young and Old. And yeah, there were a head full of ghosts. My breakout novel was inspired by Bad Religion song, A Head Full of Ghosts. So, I mean, for me, I always go back. I mean, obviously, you know, I've read a ton to obviously learn how to write and, you know, be influenced by other writers. But for me, I don't know, there's always something about that music that makes me come back to it for inspiration.
Yeah, that's amazing. And like, you know, I think a lot of art forms are linked in that way, that there's influence that you can draw from all different corners of the artistic universe. And being able to, and also just like, you know, being somebody who enjoys playing music, who you know, has these fantasies about being a rock star or whatever, like being able to draw from music in your writing, I would imagine that's a nice way to feel like you're still connected to that greater musical part of the artistic universe, even if you're not on stage at Madison Square Garden or wherever.
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, I play guitar. I mean, I'm not that great. I'm okay. but I mean, for me, that part gets to be fun. And it's not as loaded with expectation now that writing is. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm happy to have the problem of, you know, publishers wanting books for me.
Right.
You know, but it is different than like me just, you know, at home banging around with my electric guitar. It's just more like of a free thing. You know, when I first started messing around with both writing and guitar playing, I was in my, we'll call it mid-20s. And there was like a few years in the mid-90s, like mid to late 90s, where I was sort of like trying to record stuff with the four track. I had a drummer friend. I never formed a band or never played out live, but we did record a bunch of stuff. I know for me, and you know, I discovered that whereas, you know, I would love to create songs, I just really struggle with the lyric side of it, which might sound goofy as a writer. You know, for me, like, you know, coming up with like semi-decent riffs was fine. But I found, you know, for me, like writing a story, whether it be a short story or a novel, what I'm good at is living in it, even if I'm not writing it. So, yeah, I walk around most of the time. You know, I'm not purposely ignoring people, especially in my house. But, you know, I find that story's there. It's being written in some ways, or our ideas are always being worked out. And when I try to write songs, that didn't work for me. Like, I would never walk around and, like, I couldn't hear a song that I created in my head or a lyric or something like that. It only works for stories. So, I don't know. I think I'm just trying to explain why I didn't stick with playing guitar and then move to writing instead. Explain for myself, for my self-shame. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, like I said, just still having, you know, this musical life that still exists, even if it's not necessarily always on public display, still digging into music as influences and something you can enjoy and all of those things is pretty cool.
No, absolutely. I mean, I it's funny, like there are days when, you know, as most writers do, get frustrated. I can easily imagine not writing. Yeah. You know, and those are the days where I'm like really frustrated. Like just imagine, oh, I could just sit on the couch and watch movies or listen to music. I have never once imagined or thought of like, oh, going through the day without music. I can't do that. It's just a part of like my daily, it's just a part of me. I'm either listening to music on the, you know, on my commute or, you know, if I'm walking the dog or, you know, I find a way to have some music as a part of my day somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. I always find it very interesting when people don't really have any interest in music, but,
Yeah,
it's kind of like,
it is weird.
I know people who hate chocolate too. So I don't know. There really is no accounting for taste. But yeah, like we said, you know, it takes all kinds, everybody, each their own, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. I feel very satisfied. I think this was a nice chat and we covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. No, I think you're hoping to blather too much.
No, definitely not.
Well, thanks. I was joking when I say I was nervous just because like, oh, you know, I've never got to talk, you know, about Husker Du or Bob, you know, other than friends, you know, who I proselytize to, obviously. So no, thank you for the opportunity to talk about one of my favorite bands, obviously, or my favorite band, I guess.
Yeah. And I always find that, like, you know, one of the reasons I love doing this is that it's a good way to learn stuff about people without doing like a standard biographical interview where it's like, where did you grow up? And, you know, I think everybody does those kinds of interviews all the time if they're doing interviews. And
right,
just being able to talk about something else that still exposes something about you, but is more just about the stuff you love and hopefully makes other people interested in the things that you're interested in.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, I never told, I don't know if it matters, but I have a semi-embarrassing like anecdote about trying to get an autograph from Bob, like when I was like 23 or 24. Like, so I don't know. Do you know, like, he famously, well, I mean, this was as of like, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. He probably hasn't changed his mind, but he somewhat famously doesn't do autographs either. Like, if you ask, he doesn't do it. Or if he does, if you do give him a pen, like, he'll just scribble. It's a scribble. It's like it looks like just a bunch of waves.
Right.
Nothing else, like tight waves. Yeah. So, of course, you know, I was in my, like I mentioned, I was young, like 23, 24 or something. And a bunch of us hung out in a show after Providence. It was in Providence, Rhode Island. We hung out after to talk to him. Our big plan was we were going to get Bob to come out to Fellini's Pizza with us. Because my friend Weird Jim worked at Fellini's Pizza. It is really good pizza. So we tried to get him to come out with us, but he didn't want to go out with a bunch of drunk, you know, 23-year-olds. And then someone said, oh, let's get on, you know. I don't know if it was someone in my group, but someone gave him a pen. He was like, autographs. You could tell he didn't want to do it. But the only piece of paper that I had on me in my wallet was my Social Security card. Because back in 1993, 94 or whatever, you carried your Social Security card around with you in your wallet. Yeah. I remember doing that. So he signed the back of my Social Security card. Just you know, the looping scribbles.
Amazing.
So there you go. Legal tender.
Yeah. That's incredible. If you're going to get something autographed, make it a legal document, you know?
I still have it, yeah.
That's great. Awesome. Thank you so much. This was amazing. The new book is out in the summer. Is that right?
Yeah, July 7th. It's called Survivor Song. Yeah, it has song in the title.
Hey, yet another link.
Yeah.
So thanks so much for making time for me. This was really fun.
And thank you, Adam. This was wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right.
I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Okay, yeah, bye.
Bye. That was so incredible. I'm so grateful to Paul for making time for me. Please read his work. It's absolutely fantastic. Fine, I'll tell you where to start. Start with A Head Full of Ghosts. There, are you satisfied? And pre-order Survivor Song while you're at it. Okay? Great. Now, other recommendations. As loyal listeners will know, I saw Chili Gonzalez in Montreal in January before the world exploded, and he was so good. This week, I watched a documentary about him called Shut Up and Play the Piano, and that was also so good. It's a great introduction to his work if you've never heard it, and it also gives a pretty good insight into his personality. He's funny and charming, but also has this monstrous ego, and he can be a total dickhead. It's a really fascinating watch, and if you like Peaches and Feist, they're in it too. So check that out. Also, for anyone who likes dance music, you should check out the online events that clubs and bars are running during lockdown. Elsewhere, which is an amazing club in Brooklyn, if you didn't know that. They did a live stream of a DJ set by Ben UFO on Saturday with a chat room for anyone who was listening. It was so much fun. Ben UFO has impeccable taste in music, so the music was great. But also, just clubgoers having a space to connect with each other and commiserate and talk about the tunes being played. It's obviously not the same thing as being together in person, but it's something. And it's what we've got for now. So seek out those events. I'm sure there are things happening in other musical genres as well. So you're going to be able to find something no matter what kind of stuff you're into. Okay, dudes, that's it. As always, please, for the love of all that's right and good, follow me on social media at Spark Parade, and then write me a nice review and rate the show 5 stars, if you please. Other than that, stay home, stay safe, and wash your motherfucking hands. Until next time, bye.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy 2, get 2 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.